The following program is brought to you in part by the film Backdoor Channels, The Price of Peace.
Welcome to another Leon China Report, and as I promised you, it's part two of our in-depth interview with Graham Allison, the former dean of the John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard professor, served in the Reagan government for Secretary Weinberg, and he served everybody. He's brilliant, understands what's going on in the world, and unfortunately understands what's going on in the world because he has written a book called Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe, and we're going to get into this book today. Last week we talked a little bit about the background, what causes terrorism, fanaticism, and strategic terrorism, and tactical terrorism, which a lot of people don't think about. They think it's a bunch of guys getting together and then wanting to shoot up people, and it's wrong. It's what people strategically want to do to change the world. This probably goes back to the days when the Crusaders were trying to change the world with the Muslims in the Spanish days, so it is not a simple matter. The thing that's wonderful about Graham is that there is possibly a solution, and that's what we're going to talk about. Graham, welcome back. Thank you for coming on twice. It's the only time in our history we've done this, but we think it's just the penultimate of importance.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So let's go through the book a little bit. How do we prevent this? Let's talk a little bit about it.
Well, the book I try to address to ordinary, thoughtful Americans who are prepared to address a dismal subject, but nonetheless a real danger. It has two parts. The first part says inevitable, if we just keep doing what we're doing.
The attack will be inevitable.
A nuclear terrorist attack on America is inevitable if we just keep doing what we're doing. In fact, I believe unless we make some significant departure from current behavior,
tell me what the behavior
a nuclear terrorist attack will occur within a decade. And I bet $51, I've got a bunch of bets out, in which just to make sure that people get it, I'll bet $51 against your $49 that unless we make a sharp departure from what we're now doing, there's a nuclear terrorist attack within the decade.
All right,
but part two says preventable.
I want you to explain to me what is our behavior today. What is it?
Well, our behavior today, let me give you three incandescent facts,
okay.
And that's your bottom lines, then we can go back to how this is happening.
Right.
First, in the 2 years after 9/11, which we were agreeing last year, you said it should be a wake-up call, in the 2 years after 9/11, fewer potential nuclear weapons of highly enriched uranium and plutonium in Russia were secured from theft than in the 2 years before 9/11. Now you say, this cannot be possibly true. I mean, before 9/11, we've been through non-Luger cooperative programs helping make sure that the weapons and materials in Russia are locked up so they can't be stolen. But in 2 years after 9/11, we did fewer than in the 2 years before, and there's still 10,000 weapons and 20,000 potential weapons in conditions that don't make me feel comfortable in Russia. So there's one fact. Second fact. Since January 1993, North Korea, which we talked about a bit last week,
right,
has done the following things. One, withdrawn from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in which they had said they're not going to have nuclear weapons. Two, kicked out the IAEA inspectors who were there inspecting their facilities. Three, turned off the video cameras, which were 24 hours a day watching 8,000 fuel rods, which contain enough plutonium for six more nuclear bombs. And four, been moving those, they moved those 8,000 fuel rods to reprocessing facilities where every day they're now producing more material to make these six new nuclear weapons. In response to that, what have we done? Nothing, nothing. We haven't bombed them, we haven't sanctioned them, we've said, well, we'll talk to them from time to time, but only if we have six-party talks. And so about every 6 weeks, we have these desultory six-party talks, as if time was on our side, but time is on their side. I mean, I talked to actually a North Korean fellow about this, and he said, he was clearly puzzled. What was the Bush administration doing? I mean, it's making as if talking to them was a concession. All the time, these guys are just sitting there making a new fact on the ground every day. So that's the second thing.
Third. No, I want to ask you that question. Why?
Why?
Bush doesn't understand that an atomic bomb can kill his kid or my kid or your kid. I don't understand it.
Well,
pedantic about it.
No, there's a big disconnect. Because President Bush, when you talk to him, I've not talked to him, but I know senators who've talked to him about this. He can talk about this. And even when he gives a speech, he says, the ultimate nightmare is the world's most destructive technologies in the hands of the world's most dangerous actors.
Okay.
Good line.
Good line.
What the most destructive technology? Nuclear. Who the most dangerous actors? Al-Qaeda, terrorists, people like who did 9/11.
Right.
Now, so how can we therefore not be doing everything feasible and the most urgent? Answer, it's befuddling, absolutely befuddling. It's just kind of a disconnect. Now, I think if you were to, when I ask my friends in the administration, I say, look, this just makes no sense. They say, well, do you remember how many obstacles there are? Well, what obstacles? Well, the Russian security services when we're trying to help secure material at a facility, think that we're spies. And there's a debate about liability. I mean, this is unbelievable, but you can read this in the congressional hearing in February. Bush and Putin at a summit agreed 2 years ago that 4,000 potential nuclear weapons worth of plutonium in Russia was going to be eliminated. So that was agreed. So signed. They announced it. This is happening. Now, in February, Bush gave another speech saying nuclear terrorism is a big problem and we need to be doing more about this. So Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, went to testify at the Foreign Relations Committee. And Senator Lugar, who's been one of the real stand-up heroes, the Republican senator from
Indiana,
he said to him, well, Mr. Secretary, I want to ask you about this debate about liability, which has stymied any action. So zero action on these 4,000 potential nuclear weapons.
Right.
Powell reaction was as if he didn't even know what the issue was.
Is that right?
Absolutely. You can read it in the hearing. He says, non-Lugar is a great program. We're in favor of non-Lugar. But he didn't address the question at all. And
back up with me for 1 minute. Colin Powell, have you spoken with him?
I have, and I'm a great admirer of Colin Powell. I worked with him in the Reagan administration. I regard him as a hero. Yeah.
Explain it to me.
I think
you can't, huh?
My impression is either you sort of get it with respect to this issue or you don't. That you either feel it in your gut and in your bones or it just seems too big, too abstract, too.
You're gonna laugh. You know what the key to your book is gonna be? Whether Walmart sells this book. Whether the average American is going to become interested in it. And I'm not being facetious. You know, Walmart went into the book.
Yes.
If they can do this book instead of a John Affleck or whoever it is, or Cusack book, then they will know that people are involved and America is involved. And if not, God bless America. We're going to need it. All right, I'm sorry I interrupted.
Well, no, I mean, the reason why I'm being more active about promoting a book, I mean, the book is a vehicle for trying to communicate a set of ideas.
Right.
Because I think it is the case that unless at least thoughtful Americans, and maybe all Americans, but at least enough Americans, insist that their congressmen and their senators and their presidents and their secretaries of state do everything technically feasible on the fastest possible timetable, we're obviously not doing it. So what should be happening is that influentials like you and like others, I'm hoping in your audience, should say to their congressman, to their senator, excuse me, get an explanation of how can these 4,000 potential nuclear weapons be sitting there 2 years later without somebody having done something about this. This is not an acceptable behavior. And then if you look at the 9/11 hearings, which I watched some of on television, in both, unfortunately, both in Democrats in the Clinton administration and Republicans in the Bush administration, had one of these kind of lines like, well, you know, everybody did everything they could, and we tried as hard as we could, but the people were not demanding that we do any more. The political climate was not compatible with our, you know, Clinton couldn't have gone and snatched bin Laden when he was being, you know, when he was flying from Sudan to Afghanistan, and his plane stopped in the Middle East, because, you know, what would people have said, or what would the people want? So I would say thoughtful people ought to be saying to their leaders and their representatives, their congressmen, their senators, this is a real threat to us. If a nuclear weapon goes off in my city, I'm going to take it personally, okay? Yeah. And so...
More than personally.
Yeah. So I'm asking you, if you're not doing everything that you can do, why not? And if the people whom you oversee, if you're a senator or a congressman on your committee, when they come up, they get to be confirmed by you, they have to report to you what they're doing, you give them the money, you say, explain to me, what is the reason why you can't get over this? Ultimately, it comes, I think, to presidential leadership. Unless a president says, for my administration, this is an absolute priority, and for me personally. And so what I'm going to do is everything I can, every day that's feasible, and I'm going to tell every member of my national security team, that's your job. Don't tell me that there's an obstacle. You tell me that you've done it on the fastest technically feasible timetable. Don't tell me money is the problem, because this is relatively cheap. So money is not the issue.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, and relative to the consequences,
it doesn't matter.
It's risk sort of reward. Trivial.
Risk reward
would be trivial. But in any case, if you run into an obstacle you can't get around or over or under, you come back to me and tell me and think why. So, oh, well, there's a liability difference with Russia over who should be liable if this happens. The Secretary of State should call a foreign minister and say, this problem has going to be solved today. And if he can't solve the problem, he should come back to Bush and say, I can't solve this problem. And Bush should call Putin and say, excuse me, let's just tell him, fix this problem now. So I think what you haven't had is this bolt of lightning to mobilize or to energize.
Your hope is the book will generate this.
I would wish and pray that a president and a vice president and the secretary of state, that others would sort of say, oh, I got it. And so we're going to determine that we're going to do this. Now, that doesn't mean it's easy to do. There's still a lot of work to do. As you said before, 95% of the work is really just rolling up your sleeves and doing it. But these are the thing about this, and the reason why I call this the ultimate preventable catastrophe, the things that we have to do are feasible. Locking up things that we don't want people to steal is a fairly well-developed... Human beings have been about this for a long time.
Right.
We don't lose any gold from Fort Knox, not an ounce. Russia doesn't lose any treasures from Kremlin armory, none. So you say, well, could you lock up nuclear weapons and material, you know, as securely as gold? To which the answer is, I'd say, you know, what is gold? I mean, gold is just money. Nuclear weapons can kill you. So after, if God forbid, we just keep doing what we're doing, and a nuclear weapon or material from which terrorists make a nuclear weapon come loose, stolen by some crook in Russia or Pakistan or North Korea or Iran, okay, gets in the hand of Al-Qaeda, comes to New York or Boston or L.A., blows up the city, and people say, well, you know, we just thought that it would be too hard to lock this stuff up, you know, as good as gold. I mean, that was, you know, that would require a bank or, you know, some other thing.
Mm-hmm.
To which the answer, you would say, you don't want to go say that. You would just say, I made a huge, huge failure of judgment about what mattered most.
So how do we do that? How do you go about locking up?
Well, in the book, I say what we need to do and what a president needs to do is say, this is an absolute priority for my administration, and I'm going to organize a global coalition, because America can't do this by itself. I'm going to organize and mobilize a global coalition, and what I call for, I'd say we should even make it an alliance. So we have a new alliance, like NATO, but another one that we call an alliance against nuclear terrorism. The people who sign up for this alliance, and the president would...
Countries.
countries would start with the president of the country or the prime minister, who would personally to the other presidents pledge that he personally and his government would do everything technically feasible on the fastest possible timetable to secure the nuclear weapons and materials in their country. So this would start with Bush and Putin, or President of the U.S. and Putin. They would sit down and they would say, what are big threats to our countries and to our civilization? And if they can't get to this conclusion pretty quickly, I would be surprised. So they talk about the threat, not I've got a whole solution for you. We're going to agree a common assessment of threat. Then they agree on a common strategy. And the common strategy should be, let's have this alliance that includes everybody. We start by jointly defining a gold standard. So we're going to lock it up as good as gold. And then each of us pledges that in our own country, we will assure that for our weapons and materials, they're secured on the fastest possible timetable, everything technically feasible. And then, better than that, I'm going to give you some visibility about what I did so you can feel comfortable the terrorist not going to steal a weapon from Russia to use it against me, and I'm going to let you have some visibility about my system, because we don't need to steal a nuclear weapon from Russia. We have too many nuclear weapons. They don't need to steal a nuclear weapon from us. So getting clues from Russians about potential vulnerabilities in the American system, I mean, we've had this case of some security lapses at Los Alamos recently, right. So that's not a bad idea. And getting clues for Putin from U.S. experts about where there may be gaps in the Russian system if once he had implemented such a thing. So I'd say, first we define the close in. Then we go around and we sign up everybody else in the club.
It would take goodwill, though, wouldn't it?
Well, I think it'll take good persuasion. I think that the interests, this is a case where the interests of the nuclear weapon states are totally aligned. No, Russia don't want to lose nuclear weapons to Chechens. Chinese don't want to lose nuclear weapons to Uyghurs, who they're separatists, or Taiwanese. Indians and Pakistanis know they got a bunch of people who are terrorists, you know, operating in their territory in Kashmir. So they don't want to lose nuclear weapons. So going around and signing up the other leaders and then developing a process in which, in a manner that's sufficiently transparent, they each lock down all the weapons and all the materials. That's the first organizing principle, and I'd say we do it in three principles. First, no loose nukes, everything to the gold standard. Secondly, no new nascent nukes. That means no new national production of highly enriched uranium and plutonium, and Iran is the test case for that, and so we should probably talk about that. And then the third no is no new nuclear weapon states, and that's the North Korea case. But right now, this is my view, and this is a view I think that's kind of that people who are thinking about it are coming to appreciate more than they did before. We've had this thing called the non-proliferation regime, which right. is the Non-Proliferation Treaty and a lot of other treaties and agreements. For 50 years, it's kept things sort of somewhat under control. Not completely. There's now 8 nuclear weapon states, but there's not 80. Okay? This whole system is just about at the tipping point. It's just at the point where it could explode. If North Korea gets across the line and declares itself to be a nuclear weapon state, which it will do, if nothing happens dramatically, and if Iran gets across the line of finishing its infrastructure for its nuclear weapons program, which it will also do if nothing dramatic happens, then this whole structure that we've thought about before will explode. And we'll see nuclear dominoes in Asia, which will include Japan and South Korea quickly. And in the Middle East, we'll see nuclear dominoes, which will include Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and maybe Syria. And then it's going to be terrible enough for the people that live in that neighborhood with respect to the risks, okay, of nuclear war locally. And that, since we have a lot of allies there, that matters a lot to Americans. But even more to me, it's going to mean loose nukes, where some weapons are going to be in the hands of terrorists, and some of those terrorists are going to successfully bring them to the U.S., and we're going to be victims of nuclear terrorist attacks.
So, but if you have a nuclearized world, there is no world. I mean, what happens?
I think it's Thomas Hobbes told us about that in the 17th century. He said life would become nasty, brutish, and short.
There was a book written called The Masada Complex, which was a fictional book, and basically came down to the point that Israel had atomic weapons, but in a sense they wouldn't use it because that would explode the whole area and they themselves would be contaminated. So you would think that at one point, unless you get people like Bin Laden, who really don't care about the human life, but you got to believe, well, you know, Stalin was a pretty egregious guy and a pretty nasty guy and killed a lot of people. And you would think that he would want his kids to live, but I'm not sure. You know, the human element seems to defy everything. One would think that people would want to survive. And but you're right. We talked last week about the evil mind of Hitler or these Al-Qaeda's or Osama bin Laden's. So it's desperate.
It's a recurring...
If you are correct, then there is a little bit of hope. But what you need, I think, is, as you say, very good persuasion.
Well, there's a recurring, I would say, illusion that Americans are especially susceptible to. This is a Henry Kissinger point, because a German or somebody, a European that's been more...
What's his point?
His point is that that Americans want to believe that everybody just wants to live at home, be comfortable, be happy, and not threaten each other. And so that absent a few bad apples, everything is fine, and we can live in our little garden by ourselves, and we don't face urgent threats. 9/11 should have shattered that illusion, and people, even now I find some people kind of forgetting, but they shouldn't forget. The people who attacked us on 9/11 are working hard right now to attack us again.
It's quite depressing, and...
But what I think it shouldn't be depressing. I think it should be energizing. That there will be other terrorist attack on America of some sort is 100% in my view, 100%.
Why do you feel that strongly?
Well, just because there's enough people out there who hate us, and we're enough in other people's faces, given that we're the only sole superpower, that we'll antagonize some people, unquestionably, and however good a job we do of defending ourselves at home, we're also, we haven't talked about that, but we're doing a poor job today, I believe, a poor job. But however well we do, again, they go through the weakest link in the chain. But that's on the one hand. It is not inevitable, that these terrorists who want to attack us will have the means to kill millions of people. That's only if we let them succeed. And we have an opportunity now, if we act quickly and with determination, to prevent them from acquiring nuclear weapons or materials. So that one we can sort of put off the table. And if we don't put it off the table and we find ourselves victim of it, I mean, 9/11, horrible, horrible, horrible event. Does life in America go on? Yes, we're surviving. Okay. Israel. How in the world do people live in a country where every day you might be blown up on a bus or in a restaurant or in a shopping center or so forth? I don't know. I mean, when I talk to my Israeli friends, I say, you know, I don't...
It becomes part of their life.
Well, they somehow... Human beings are fantastically adaptable. But do one or two nuclear terrorist attacks in America and tell me what is America. And I can't go there. You know?
What gets me more ominously afraid is that you could get a suicide bomber carrying a nuclear weapon, doesn't care, and just go in and go to the Empire State Building and shoot up the place. Because you have the mentality of a suicide bomber now, together with nuclear terrorists.
But you don't even, I mean, it's worse than that. I mean, I agree. I mean, because we now, you know, before people didn't know about suicide bombers, as if we didn't know about kamikazes who did this before. But in any case...
But it wasn't that prevalent.
Yeah, but if Al-Qaeda gets a nuclear weapon, I go through in part one of the book, who could do it, Al-Qaeda?
Right.
What could they do it with? A suitcase-sized nuclear
bomb.
Where could they get it? Here's a bunch of places. When could they have it? Now. How could they get it here? Every way the drugs come into America. Just follow the drugs. Okay. So there's a lot of ways for this to happen. If this happens, we're going to say... I don't see how we're even going to explain to ourselves why, for the absence of things we could do. So the reason why I'm not pessimistic about this. This is a solvable problem. There's a finite list of things to be done. Unfortunately, some of them we're not doing. So our president needs to say, we're absolutely going to do these. And if there's some reason why you can't do it if you're working for me, you just tell your boss. And if your boss tells me, and I will either solve the problem or I'll find somebody else who can solve the problem. This is a list of things that are doable. So for absence of doing them, and the case, if I say, what the most likely case? Here's Al-Qaeda, which has been for 10 years working the nuclear problem. So is it possible that they have solved this problem now? Yes, it is. We don't know. But they were 6 years working on the 9/11 attack. So they have a cell that's undoubtedly working the nuclear thing. If they get a nuclear weapon, if they get 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium, that's about a six-pack of beer if the cans were filled of highly enriched uranium. So it's smaller than a football. They build a Hiroshima-style bomb, the design for which is publicly available, so on the internet. We never tested that design. It's so robust, it's so simple, that it was never tested. It was the first time ever used was Hiroshima. So they put it in that form. They put that bomb in a van, like the van that Mr. Yosef parked in the basement of the World Trade Center.
Right.
That's about how big it is.
Okay? Right.
So they drive the van in somewhere. They can then remote detonate it if the guy don't want to commit suicide.
That's right.
So the guy didn't even have to be a suicide bomber to do this. And the only way to prevent this happening, I mean, we need to have good NEST teams to find it in New York if it's there, but they can't. That's hard work, because technology makes it easier for the hider than for the seeker. We need to have borders, which we don't have as a country. We should become serious about borders. That's another view, but we don't have now. We should be serious about stopping things when they're on the sea. But the best place to stop this, the only place to successfully stop it, is at the source. At the source, you can lock things down. As Sam Nunn says, every mile you get away from the source, it gets easier for the terrorists and harder for the defender.
All right, we're going to cut for a break, Graham. We'll come right back. What's interesting about this book is that before 9/11, probably maybe 30 people would be interested, because I think Henry Kissinger was right. The American dream is everything is good, fun Sunday football, a nice dinner, and tra-la-la-la. But we are another country today. We are post 9/11. We have been attacked worse than kamikaze pilots on Pearl Harbor. And this is a new world, and this is the place that we, as Americans, have to be to try and stop this. Otherwise, it's all gone. You can take away your wills to your kids and your charitable contributions to the Kennedy School. It won't matter. We'll be right back.
Full life, measured in seats, starts with the right ones early on. Car crashes are the number one killer of children 1 through 13. Learn how to prevent deaths and injuries by using the right car seat for your child's age and size.
Kitchen surfaces, utensils, and hands with soapy water. 1 in 6 Americans will get sick from food poisoning this year. Keep your family safer. Check your steps at foodsafety.gov.
Every book is an adventure waiting to come to life. Visit new worlds. encounter new friends, and discover the power of reading. Go to read.gov to read A Princess of Mars, the first novel to feature John Carter. A new world awaits. Read.
The average text takes your eyes off the road for nearly 5 seconds.
Getting closer to nature can get you closer to your family. Go to discovertheforest.org.
Osteoarthritis pain. For more information on managing pain, go to fightarthritispain.org.
I help you find a home.
I help you find a home.
Hey, maybe you'll be picked next.
Maybe you'll be picked next.
We've been caged together too long.
We've been caged together too long.
How come nobody ever picks me?
Maybe they're looking for somebody different.
Pick me.
Well, the shelter's closing up for another day.
We didn't get picked.
I know.
Tomorrow. Guaranteed.
Can you sit with me? Imagine what you'd see if every child had a book to read.
Read to a child today and spark a lifetime of ambition.
We're back. I'm Leon Charney. We are talking in Washington, D.C., part two of our series with Graham Allison, who's written the most important book, I think, of the year called Nuclear Terrorism. And really, it has to do with everybody's life, mine, yours, your grandkids. You can change your wills, not change your will. It won't matter, because if this thing is not curtailed, then, you know, Graham is optimistic that we can do it, which is probably one of the best things I've heard all week in Boston, that we can really curb this, because then we can save the world. I mean, you know, we used to read books like this in science fiction in the 1960s, 70s, and, you know, the world explodes and blows up. But as I said before, and Graham obviously agrees, 9/11 has transformed everything. The United States can't worry about everything in a world. It has to prioritize. And the first thing it has to do is make sure that the world exists. So we'll continue with Graham. Graham, really appreciate spending this much time with us. But I think you and I are on the same page. We believe it is really important for the world. And at this convention site, I think the most important issue, whether it be Bush or Kerry, what you really want is someone to grab this issue, make it known, popularize, and then sort of get an alliance with countries who can come together and stop it. And it's like preventive medicine, which is a lot better than have medicine after you're sick. Am I correct, Graham?
Absolutely. And
so now, how do you do this? I mean, okay, you're a man of great stature. You've worked all over the governments and all. Will they listen to you? do people listen?
In the, as I said when we were chatting earlier about it, I think the, I would be just as happy for a Republican administration as a Democratic administration
to do
this. You would
be happy if Nader took it.
Absolutely, if he were the president, yes.
Right.
The in the Bush administration, I've made an effort with colleagues and friends to press this case. I now look at the performance of the Bush administration at this point. And as I said, I have to give them failing marks. Are we safer from a nuclear terrorist attack than we were before Bush? And the answer is no. And why? Because the facts I mentioned before. So I would say they had their chance and they failed. Now, if tomorrow there was a deathbed conversion or a last-minute conversion, and
there.
Bush got seized and said, we're doing it, I'd be there. But that's where they are. In the case of Kerry, he's thought about this problem. He gave a speech on June 1st at West Palm Beach, which I watched him work on himself. And you can see a man speaking with conviction. He says he believes this is the most important problem, and I believe him. He says he would make this his most urgent priority.
Is that right?
That's what he says in the speech, and I believe him. But again, there's a difference between promise and performance. And so if he goes and seizes this problem, I would be happy to sweep, to clean, to cheerlead, to do whatever. If Bush were to take this, I mean, I'm interested in what I think is an existential threat to America as a country that we all live in, and that we won't be able to live in anything like the way we currently do.
Period.
Right.
Have you talked to colleagues in foreign countries about this?
I have.
You guys are in touch all the time, I'm sure.
I have a good friend who was Yeltsin's national security advisor, Andrei Kokoshin. We were at a meeting in June, and I was chatting with him about this. Now, he doesn't like this much blame about Russia because he says, you know, well, look, we haven't lost any weapons yet. And I say, well, at least I haven't found any weapons that you've lost, so that's good. Actually, the Russian performance and the performance of the Russian military and security services has been extraordinary. That is the
success. I think they did a good job in Ukraine, too. I was there with Bill Clinton a couple of years ago,
right.
And I think they took out their nuclear weapons.
They did. So,
am I correct?
That was a collaborative effort between Russia and the U.S., and I was in the Clinton administration working the one side, and Kokoshin was one of the people on the other side, so there was active cooperation there. So he would say, well, you know, don't point the finger at Russia so much, because obviously Russians are a little bit, but he agrees that this is the most urgent issue. He's especially interested in the North Korean and Iranian cases, both of which he sees would be horrible outcomes for Russia. He's very worried about the AQCON black marketeering network. So I think that there's a little bit of dawning recognition in a few places. When I talk to Europeans about this, they mainly think this is some crazy American preoccupation because, and actually this is another one
You're
of the-
talking France, Germany?
France, Germany, even a lot of Brits. One of the unrecognized costs of the Iraq War is that since it was marketed as the war to prevent Saddam transferring weapons of mass destruction to terrorists, I mean that was the rationale. We get there and we find out it's a false premise. Then Europeans, and not only Europeans, a lot of Mideasterners, I was at a meeting with a bunch of folks in the Mideast just in June, think, well, this was a trick, that Bush didn't really mean it. He just uses that flag to try to give a justification for what he's doing. And I say to him, no, this really is the most urgent threat. And they say, yeah, but that's what Bush said about Iraq. And I say, well, let's just look at the facts about North Korea, and they say, well, we don't even know whether we believe, you know, what CIA says about North Korea, because they didn't know what was going on in Iraq. What about the North, even the Chinese?
So they've lost faith in us.
There's been a substantial
erosion
of American credibility.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. There was a case in the first book I ever wrote was on the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, really?
There's a wonderful instance in there in which Kennedy has said we've discovered these missiles and nuclear missiles in Cuba, and nobody knows because so. They send Dean Acheson, who was the former Secretary of State, to France to talk to de Gaulle.
Right.
And he says, there's these nuclear missiles, and we've brought you the evidence. And de Gaulle says, I don't need to see any evidence. The President of the United States says that there's nuclear missiles there. I'm standing with them. Now,
it wouldn't happen today.
That's a huge
statement, by the way. There's been an erosion of the credibility of the United States and the CIA and et cetera, et cetera. I have to tell this to the audience. Most of you have probably never been in political situations or White Houses and government jobs like Graham and I have been. I've been more of a consultant. He's taken payroll. I've tried to give it back. I used to work for $1 a year or less if I could. But you must understand that what seems so logical and so important is sort of commingled with so many different things and events that it's really hard to get through a purpose that you think is very important. It is so important that a man like Graham try to drive this through because of the powerful intellectual capacity he has and the government, I mean the Kennedy School, etc., they're prominent and the most prominent. It's a tremendous dedication, and he doesn't even know what he's in for. Maybe he does, because it is a tireless, tough job. I've seen it. And one must commend him for doing this. And, I know what you're going to go through. It's not going to be easy. It is not easy to move. You want to move a policy. You want to bring an alliance. You want to do something, and you think it's the most necessary thing in the world. And I know the politicians. I know the pragmatism. I know what you got to go through, but I am very, very honored to be with you because of your commitment to this, and I am with you on this 100%.
Well, I appreciate you're overly generous, but I appreciate what you say. I think what I've tried to do is write as clearly and candidly as I can, not as a political document, but as a national security analyst and as an American, what I think needs to be done now. I agree with you entirely. Somebody, and that's going to be a president, is going to have to take this and do it if they want to do it. Now, then they're going to enlist some helpers, and if I were happy, I'd be happy to be a helper if anybody needed one, whoever was doing it. But this is really heavy lifting for a president who wants to do it, and if a president doesn't want to do it, it's clear that the underlings are not going to be able to succeed. So most of the real work, just what you said, the real work of moving it is 5% is represented by a clear picture and a plan. 95% is blocking and tackling.
Right, yeah. It's a football game. Let me diverge for 1 minute. Do you know the history of how Harry Truman came to use the atomic bomb? Have you studied that?
I've read the history, but I haven't studied it in great detail.
That also must have been a tremendous inside fight in that White House.
Well, it's interesting. The fellow who was one of my great mentors who died last year, Richard Neustadt, who's the greatest American student of the presidency.
Right.
He worked in the Truman White House. And I asked him about this because I was quite puzzled. He was friendly with Truman. Truman came and visited him when he was a professor at Columbia. He said Harry Truman didn't lose a night's sleep over this, that they...
He knew right and wrong, and the
Japanese had attacked us. We were at total war with them. Defeating Japan was going to cost some hundreds of thousands of American lives if we had an invasion plan, and he had looked and seen what were the estimates from the military planners. And indeed, it was going to cost hundreds of thousands of Japanese lives. So the idea that he could use some dramatic punch as he did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which anniversaries were just coming up on, if you remember. That was like August I think August 7 and August 9 or something like that. Yeah. He did it. It wasn't such a thing. And as he said afterwards to Neustadt, and even I think publicly, you know, he didn't lose a night's sleep over it. So it was a kind of a different time.
Graham, at the end of the day, having been in private life too and entrepreneurish, money is always a factor. Money is always a factor. Do we have to bottle up the money also? It's another capacity from buying this nuclear energy, or if it's locked, will you develop a black world, a black male, or whatever there is going on? Do you attack that problem too?
That's a very thoughtful question, and it relates to the whole broader war on terrorism. But I think the finding ways to make sure, in the first instance, all the weapons and all the materials are locked up as good as gold on the fastest possible timetable is the first immediate step. That's something you can sort of do now, fast. Then where there is material that can't be secured,
right,
or where you're worried about the long-term security because of the money component of it, that needs to be eliminated. And one of the nice things that happened, and that has been happening, is that the nuclear weapons that were in Ukraine, which I worked on, and which got removed back to Russia, they are being destroyed. The uranium in them is blended down to low-enriched uranium. Low-enriched uranium can go into a civilian nuclear power plant, and you burn it up. So you've got a project here that a company, an American company called USEC, runs called Megatons to Megawatts. So you take this material, you take it from a warhead, you take it, and it's 90% highly enriched uranium. You blend it with other material, and it gets down to 2%. You take the 2% material, and you put it in nuclear power reactors like the one here in Boston or the one in New York. So that's burning it up. That gets rid of the stuff entirely. In countries where there's a currently material for bombs, like the former Yugoslavia, where there were three bombs until the end of 2000, or to the middle of 2000, there's 20 other countries today where terrorists could go, like Belarus or Uzbekistan.
Graham, is there a technology that we have that we know exactly where all this stuff is in the world? Do we have sort of a listing of it, even where the people have it under the ground or blackmailed or whatever they, do we know?
I don't think that there's a 100% inventory that one could be 100% confident about, but I think we have a pretty good picture of where the weapons and materials are that are the most dangerous. And I think if we had a project, that the one that I'm recommending, to lock up and clean out this material, that's an issue. So there's always a risk that some little bit of material is already stolen by some group.
Right.
I mean, Al-Qaeda could have it right now.
Right.
But I think that the odds are reasonable that we could lock it all up.
Give me your gut feeling when President Bush said there are weapons of mass destruction. In the beginning, were you cynical about it, or you didn't know, or?
In the case of Iraq, I believed him, and I believed the CIA estimates of the time.
So you thought it was plausible?
Not nuclear. I thought Cheney's statements about Iraq having a nuclear program, I thought were exaggerated, and they were way beyond anything that CIA said. But chemical and biological weapons, he had them before. He hadn't given account of what happened to him, so it seemed plausible to me, yeah.
You remember the UN Resolution 1441?
Yes.
That happens to be the name of my office building. But I had Scott Ritter on my show. I had the fellow from Australia who became head of weapons, former ambassador from Australia.
Yes.
He was on my show.
Name, yeah.
I mean, these guys...
Butler,
were, yeah. Yeah, right. UN Resolution 1441.
Yes.
That happens to be the name of my office building. But I had Scott Ritter on my show. I had the fellow from Australia who became head of weapons,
Oh,
former ambassador from Australia.
Yes.
He was on my show. Yeah. I mean, these guys.
Butler, were, yeah.
Yeah, right. Australian. These were, well, we had to change the story, so, you know, I think he's a comic for television, but Butler was very down on Saddam. He really thought he had bad things going on there. Is it possible that this guy really had weapons and they're still hidden someplace? What do you think?
Well, I think the best, the person whose judgment I think is the best about yeah. this, whom I follow, is David Kaye, who was the
Inspector
person
from the CIA.
Appointed by Bush to right. go find the weapons. And he looked all the places where all the evidence that we had would have suggested the weapons would have been, and he was part of the interrogation of all the scientists that we had, and he's concluded that there were no such weapons. Now, that doesn't mean that we may not still, you know, that something could turn up. I mean, what happened in this case, and I've talked to Kay about this at some length, the inspectors, the UN inspectors, turned out to have done a lot better job than we gave them credit for.
Yeah.
And we should have actually, if we had been learning, this was, I think, a big mistake made by the Bush administration and by most of the rest of us, that as the inspectors were out there inspecting, U.S. government said, we know where all this stuff is. So they would tell them a spot. They would go there and there would be nothing. So we had done that already about 10 times when the inspectors were back in there before Bush rushed to war. So if you were updating your priors on the basis of, you know, CIA says, we know what this is. You go there and you look and you can't find anything. You would say, well, okay, give me another target. So you go there. You don't find anything. Well, give me another target. After four or five of those exercises, or 10, you would say, your sources don't seem to be very good. So that was a failure. Second failure was, CIA had no spies there. I mean, again, we're a great country. We're a great military power. As the 9/11 Commission report shows, our intelligence community has been badly broken. Now, this is not just under Bush. This is under Bush, Clinton. This goes back several administrations, but it does mean that as a country, we now have a big, big, big task of rebuilding the clandestine services, which are spies who could live in a place like Iraq and get around and find information. You can't just get that by taking pictures or by listening to conversations. And also of covert action to be able to snatch somebody like bin Laden. In fact, I think that we're having to cope with two great failures in the inability to deal with Osama bin Laden before 9/11 and the failures of intelligence in the run-up to the war on Iraq, which then should scare us about our ability to wage a real war on nuclear terrorism, because in a war on nuclear terrorism, we need the very best intelligence we can get, including by spies who inside systems will help us find out what's going on, and the ability to take covert action so we don't have to go and invade every country. It'd be perfectly fine to have a fire somewhere. Yeah.
I don't know if you know, but does the CIA have a section for nuclear terrorism investigation? Do the NSA, which is National Security, do they? I don't know. Do
they have a group? They have a group that listens and watches, and some talented
people. But
no
men on the ground.
But, I mean, it's just... Again, whenever I say this, people say, oh, this can't possibly be true. But
sounds
I think the reason why the 9/11 Commission report deserves reading is that if you look, these institutions are more broken and less able to meet our real national interest today than is required, which is why, again, I believe President Bush should, in the 33 months since 9/11, we've had plenty of time to be doing things. Plenty of time to be doing big things, and we haven't been doing very much.
Did you people at Harvard know that these institutions were bad, or you had no idea?
I have been saying now for, but I've been regarded as kind of a, you know, a little bit on the lunatic fringe and saying, you can't have a great country and not have spies, it's a lot of spies, and that getting a spy is hard work, very hard work, and especially in countries where if people look like me and they're trying to deal with somebody that looks a different color, you know, I stand out. So but if you look and say, how many people do we have that look like that work there? Not very many. There's one CIA director of operations person says, we don't go and stay in countries that have diarrhea. Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of those places, those hell holes, right, which is where we've got things to do. Also, we have had this craziness, as far as I'm concerned, which says, well, we're certainly not going to deal with spies who ever violated anybody's human rights. These people are horrible people. I'm not interested. I mean, yeah, I don't like it that they tortured a nun or did some other horrible thing. But that doesn't mean that I'm not interested in trying to get information out of them, because I'm interested in protecting America. And in the case of covert action now, I mean, I write in this book on nuclear terrorism. We have more lawyers that work for the Directorate of Operation than we have spies. So we have a bunch of people saying, well, don't do anything wrong, which is correct. We don't want people out rogues running around doing this or that. But it's gotten, I mean, I think, unfortunately, it's broken, and there's a lot of rebuilding to do. And the rebuilding is necessary as part of the arsenal that we need for preventing nuclear terrorism.
Graham, it's unfortunate we're out of time. It's been really a pleasure, and more than a pleasure, it's been very important for the country to see this. And I hope you're right. I hope that we can get to a place where this is preventable. And I do appreciate your time. And it's not that I wish you luck. I wish the American people luck that they follow you in this. And we won't consider you an outrageous person for this. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much for having me. It's been a very interesting interview for me.
It's very important. This is the book that everybody should have an interest in. We'll see you next week.
Who says you can't teach an old dog new tricks? Maybe you should go to your shelter and get a mature dog who will make your blues disappear. How's that for tricks? I got picked. Wow.
Get involved, get going at letsmove.gov.